silent when the judge asked if he would enter a guilty or not guilty plea. At that point, the judge entered a not guilty plea on behalf. He read them through the procedural process of five counts, count one, burglary, count two, three, four, and five, murder in the first degree, in the deaths and murders of Madison Mogan, Kaylee Gonsalves, Zanna Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin. The maximum penalty, what's it like in there and for these families as they prepared for this difficult day?
There were about 25 family members representing the four victims, which was a lot. There were a lot of people that I didn't even recognize that hadn't been to the hearings in the past. It was a very, very small courtroom, so they took up about half of the courtroom, all seated on one side. They were emotional even before court began, and then they brought in right before they started the proceeding. And again, it's so small that where they were sitting was really very, very close to Koberger. So it made for a somewhat uncomfortable situation, obviously, for them to be that close to the man accused of killing their loved ones. But they powered through it.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and also host of the podcast Crime Analyst.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm casting director of CBS's Criminal Minds. And we're here. Laura wanted to jump on because she has an update on for us on the horrific murders in Idaho. And I just wanted to mention those victims' names, the killings of Ethan Chapin and roommates Madison Mogan, Zanna Kernodle, and Kaylee Gonsalves. And they were murdered Sunday, November 13th of last year. Laura?
Yes, and I think everyone is talking about this case at the moment. And one of the key things, I'm glad you said the victims' names, Lisa, because that's what I would have gone straight in with, because yes, we're giving an update in the case and it does relate to BK and we're not going to say his name in full, but I really am sick of seeing his image all over the media, the videos, the pictures. I really am sick of it. And I want us to keep centering the victims. And that's such an important part for the families. And in fact, Kaylee Gonsalves' father today has just made that statement to say, please remember our children. Please remember us in all of this, because it has become a bit of a media circus. And I have been tracking this case, as I know many others have. And last week, BK was indicted. Now, a grand jury had been meeting in secret and they heard all the evidence that exists thus far. And they indicted BK on the charges of murder and burglary. Now, that's a big deal. And I just want to talk about that part first of all, because we have had the arraignment today. But I know so many of you are confused as to what a grand jury is and what's the purpose of it. And that's why Jim Clemente is going to explain a bit about the legal side in this episode. So go ahead, Jim. What's a grand jury? Why did it happen in this case at this stage?
So generally, there are two different ways for an indictment to be handed down. One is to have a grand jury meet and convene and hand down an indictment. And two is to have a probable cause hearing. And then a judge basically issues that same indictment. So basically, a grand jury is a group of people. Usually, it's somewhere between 30 and 40. I think maybe smaller jurisdictions might have fewer numbers, but they are a jury of the regular jury pool members who are asked to sit for a particular period of time. Sometimes grand juries are convened for a month, sometimes for 6 months, sometimes for a year or two. And typically the longer ones for huge investigations are being given investigative information over the course of that month or 6 months or year. And they then are asked, they were presented with particular crimes. The crimes, the statutes are read to them, and then the district attorney asks for them to return a true bill, meaning an indictment that they are more likely than not. It's probable cause that this crime has been committed by this particular person or persons. So they're literally a way for your fellow citizens to judge whether you committed a crime, and then you're indicted and arraigned before the judge, which happened to BK today. And that is an opportunity for you to plead guilty or not guilty. And neither of those things happened, did they, Laura?
They didn't. And I think today is a very interesting set of developments to talk about. Now, just to step back, you mentioned the grand jury. Well, it happens in secret. And some people thought I was being dramatic by saying that it happened in secret. But it does, no. doesn't it? It's absolutely. And BK doesn't attend. Well, he gets a transcript, right?
Right. Yes. And the grand jurors are told not to discuss what they have heard, the evidence they've heard. And the people who give evidence are not supposed to discuss the evidence that they gave. And certainly the prosecutor and any other witnesses that are called are supposed to maintain that grand jury secrecy. Now, any information that you learn as a result of being present in a grand jury is kept secret unless and until a judge decides that they can make that grand jury transcript available. If, for example, somebody testifies in front of a grand jury and then testifies at trial, if they change their testimony, for example, that grand jury testimony can be used against them. They can even be subject to perjury charges for either grand jury or trial testimony, because they have to swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth. But you can use the grand jury testimony to cross-examine somebody who takes the stand in a trial. But the grand jury proceeding is basically a way for society to be involved, for fellow citizens to be involved in a determination as to whether or not somebody gets prosecuted. And many times the district attorney in very political cases will sort of put the onus on the grand jury rather than making a political decision if it is a very difficult case or a very troublesome case.
So they're covering themselves. They're like, well, we're not bringing this to trial. The public is saying this needs to go to trial.
Yes. And in this case, we all know that the defense asked for a delay, a long delay after the arrest before the probable cause hearing would be held, because they felt they needed to do a tremendous amount of investigation. Now, it's generally the defense who wants a quick trial because their client is being held in custody. And so they typically want a quick trial. I think they realized that this was going to be a very difficult case for them and that it was going to be very difficult for them to find things to help in his defense. And so they asked for a delay. And apparently the prosecutor, although they had to agree to that, decided on their own that they were going to go ahead and present the evidence to a grand jury and get an indictment and not hold a probable cause hearing. So some jurisdictions have to have a grand jury, some jurisdictions have to have a probable cause hearing, and some jurisdictions, the prosecutor has a choice to pick one or the other. And in this case, obviously, that was the case. Prosecutor picked the grand jury over the probable cause hearing. They don't have to present all the evidence against the defendant. They only have to present the minimum amount to prove that it is more likely than not that there is actually probable cause that this person committed the crimes that they're being charged with. Apparently, the grand jury did come back with a true bill, and they did find that there is probable cause that BK committed the murders and entered that home with the intent to commit a crime therein. And that's the burglary charge.
Yes, and the burglary charge may well be the fail-safe to have that in there. But whichever way you look at it, it's not good news for him, right? That's the decision that's been taken. Now, it doesn't mean to say that he's guilty. He still will have to stand trial. So that process, well, I thought it would be some way off, but we'll come back to that because a trial date has been set today. Mm-hmm. But BK received the transcript, or his lawyers received the transcript, so they get to see what was discussed. So it's interesting what you said, Jim, that they don't have to present all of their case, right? Because at this stage, now there's a blueprint of what the prosecution's case is. Mm-hmm. So that's important to understand. And BK, it was said last week that he would be back in court today. So the arraignment has taken place. Everybody had eyes on it. And there was lots of videos now that are circulating. And BK stood silent when the judge asked for his plea, which apparently didn't look to surprise anybody, maybe the media, maybe other people in the UK, Australia, and so forth. And a lot of people won't understand what that means, that he stood silent and that the judge entered his not guilty plea. Can you explain that part of the legal process, Jim?
Yeah, well, this is a very unusual set of circumstances. Usually defendants are very eager to say I'm not guilty. And in this case, it appears that BK is just simply not participating in the process. Now, I don't know if that's because he feels like this court has no jurisdiction over him. There are a segment of people that believe that they're not part of this country and so forth. I don't know if that's what's going on.
Laura, just a question. He was silent. What did his lawyer say? Did his lawyer say anything?
No, because it's up to him to enter his plea. He has to say guilty or not guilty. They're the only words that he's meant to express. So no story around it, just guilty or not guilty. And that's for BK to say that. And because he didn't say anything, the judge then presumes he's saying not guilty. And this can be part of the defense strategy.
Hmm.
Some defense lawyers will say that he wants to leave the door open. He doesn't want to say either way just yet, because there's still going to be, 60 days for the prosecution. Now they have to decide whether they're going to seek the death penalty. And until they know what evidence they have, it might be part of his strategy. And bearing in mind, his lawyer will be leading him in this, the strategy to stay silent so that he doesn't implicate either way. It keeps the door open for him.
So it's bizarre. It sounds like a tactic. I mean, if he thinks he's innocent, he should say innocent, right? But
most would say not guilty, as Jim said, and be very keen to say not guilty. And I would expect him to say that, to want the trial and to want to have his moment in court. But this is an interesting, I think, strategy on their behalf, of wanting to keep the door open. And he may plead guilty at some point if there's a lot of overwhelming and compelling evidence. But I would suspect that they want to look at the transcript from the grand jury to know exactly what is in the prosecution's case, to see how strong it is before a plea is made. But that's one thing I wanted to hear from Jim, whether he had been involved in any cases where this had happened and whether it's likely that he will enter a plea, whether he has to legally enter a plea, within that 60 days that the prosecution must decide whether they're going to seek the death penalty or not, because it's either life without parole or a death penalty case. And I guess, we've talked about death penalty cases before, given how many miscarriages of justice there are that we've talked about, and we've just talked about the Menendez brothers. I'm not somebody who is pro death penalty, but if there were a case, this would probably be it for me, where four young, vibrant students are at home feeling that they're safe, having been on a night out, and someone breaks into their property and murders them in cold blood. And therefore, you could understand if the prosecutors do go down that line to seek the death penalty. I don't know if you have thoughts on that, Lisa and Jim.
Well, unfortunately, we have lost Jim at the moment. Never mind. Hang on. Hold that thought, Laura.
At the critical moment, Jim comes back in. He left at the critical moment and he's come back in at the critical moment. So I wondered, Jim, just to catch you up, I was saying, could it be that it's part of the defense strategy that silence is golden? They want to leave the door open. They want to know what evidence there is. They want to read the transcript. They want to know, because he may well plead guilty at some point. That might happen if the death penalty is brought in. Because it just seems to me to be very strategic in this situation that he remains silent. And I think that that could be an advantage that he's trying to play, or his defense team, and keep that door open.
Well, I guess so, but it would certainly be to his advantage to plead not guilty. You can always change your plea to guilty later if you want to plead guilty. But at this time, you plead not guilty, and that sets the court in motion to actually set a trial date. And the Brady information has to be shared. All the information from the prosecutor has to be shared with the defense. And that's just the normal process. But he's not participating in that. And I think that is like a statement by him rather than some kind of strategy. It doesn't help him to not plead guilty. But
do you think it's a control? He's trying to control the narrative or make a statement in that way?
It could be. He may not recognize the authority of the court, and he's trying to make a statement about that. I don't know. He may also be extremely upset at where he is and where he finds himself right now, because certainly this was not within his plan. But I don't know if he's participating with his defense attorneys. If he is not, it is possible that that strategically he may be not participating with his attorneys. And if that's the case, then they may have said, go ahead, don't say anything in court. And later they're going to argue that he's not participating in his own defense, and therefore he is not in a position to stand trial. They could actually be looking at some kind of insanity defense. Now, insanity doesn't mean that you're crazy. What it means is you don't understand the wrongfulness of your actions. So you can't determine right from wrong. That's what the insanity defense means.
But interestingly, he was saying to the judge that he understood the process in court today. So I did wonder too whether that insanity defense, whether they're leaving the door open on a number of things. And it does seem to be strategic, at least from him. But I think whichever way he went, people would read lots into it, right? Because there's so many eyes on him and people can read a lot more into it and say, well, it's a control thing. Well, maybe it is. Will he have to enter a plea at some point? Because I know that the prosecution has 60 days to seek the death penalty. Must he enter a plea within that time, or is there any set time that he has to?
No, well, the judge entered it for him. In other words, he just presumed, because under the law, the defendant is presumed innocent. And so he entered a not guilty plea because the defendant refused to speak. Again, this is a non-participation. This isn't a typical reaction. I mean, like I said earlier, defendants usually jump at the chance to say, I'm not guilty. But the fact that he is not participating is actually probably concerning to his attorneys, because he certainly doesn't appear innocent by not even claiming that he's innocent.
Yes, I think his silence, people can read in a lot to that. And people are actually on social media. I'm seeing all the traffic about what it might mean, but I think we'll know more. And, you know, I do wonder about whether he may plead guilty at some point. That's what I mean. If, you know, he does enter a plea, if there's some plea bargaining to be done to take the death penalty off the table, that's the only other reason that he wants to keep the door open, or his defense team do. But I don't know. Have you seen this in many other cases before, Jim?
No, it's extremely rare. And usually, I'm not even going to name the name of the group. Usually they're members of a group who feel that they do not come under the jurisdiction of the United States, that they are separatists and that they don't have to follow any rules, any laws, or participate in paying taxes and things like that. Usually those are the people that don't actually speak up in court. Or if they do speak up, it is not within the realm of what the court is asking from them.
Right. So, and he would have only have entered his plea here, guilty or not guilty. So it wasn't as if he was going to give any big narrative about the case. It was just a simple plea at the arraignment.
Either two words or one word. That's it. And he didn't choose to do it. So, you know, I'm sure you have seen evidence of it in his behavior, but I do think he is a control freak, and this may be just one way he could assert control at that moment. But the process is moving on. The judge went ahead and entered a plea of not guilty anyway, and set a date for trial. That could be delayed, that trial, depending on, you know, motions mostly from the defense. But the prosecution could ask for a delay as well if they needed it. But for speedy trial reasons, the prosecution will probably be ready at that very first date.
Well, I was surprised that October the 2nd, 8:30 a.m., that's the date that has been set. And I have to say, I was surprised about that because there's still, investigations and evidence to be compiled and discovery. There's clearly back and forth, but we will see. It would probably get pushed back. There's still hearings that have been set for June the 9th to discuss the gag order and the cameras in court. And I don't know if either of you have any views on that. The Gonzalez family, Kaylee's family, are contesting the gag order along with the Associated Press. And that hearing will be on June the 9th. So I think we'll be hearing more.
Can you explain what the gag order is?
The gag order is really there to prevent leaks of all the information and evidence going into the public court of opinion and the trial happening in the public. So they're trying to preserve the process for the trial, which is quite right, given how high profile this case is, right? To preserve that evidence that it should be heard at court. And I think Kaylee's family feel that they should be able to talk about Kaylee and be able to talk about certain developments that happen. And I feel they feel very restricted by it.
Right.
So it's a difficult process, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you can understand that they, and I'm sure they were so frustrated in the beginning of the investigation when it seemed like nothing was happening, but all along things were happening. And I got to trust law enforcement on this one. And you don't want that jury pool tainted. You want it to be a fair, speedy trial that, you know, has a positive outcome for them and what they want. So I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, in the UK, we basically have a law and a trial is sub judice. You know, once somebody's been arrested and they're charged with an offence, it can't be discussed in detail because of the court case. And I do think that there's good reason for that. So I don't want to see everybody weighing in on every aspect of the case prior to the trial. And if he is to get a fair trial, you know, because that's the other part, particularly with this case, these high profile cases with now social media influencers and everybody's got an opinion, right? His right to a fair trial starts to be seen as a problem, and that's grounds for appeal.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because then you're just going to seed all those darn appeals. So, oh, you got to feel for them. You can understand that they really want to speak out, but it's just probably better for them not to.
But yeah, I mean, there's one part where it's very cathartic for families to do that, and it can be very healing for them and to feel empowered. But I think you do have to balance it with the legal due diligence that you don't want people compromising or tainting. And I think tainting the jury pool, that is a big issue in a case like this, which so many people are paying attention to. And I also think the cameras in court is an interesting issue. You know, I personally hope, and professionally, I should say, that there aren't cameras in court, because I think it will become a big media circus. And I believe, and it's my belief and professional belief about this case, that that's what BK seeks. He enjoys that aspect to it. So I think it will be particularly unhelpful if there are cameras in court. Now, if you've got good reporters reporting on what's going on, then that's very helpful. But I think right now we have to keep the victims and their families uppermost in mind and think about them and how this must feel for them, and ensure that we circulate the pictures of them to remember the victims rather than keep seeing all the images of him, which even when we look at how he presents, he seems to be enjoying it.
Yeah,
and that's problematic.
But Laura, do you know of a case where the cameras are in court, but it's not broadcast? Because I think about the Menendez trial and how much we learned from being able to watch hours and hours and hours of all that real testimony. I mean, that's really important for a layperson like me to watch, but I don't necessarily need it broadcast every night. I mean, it seems like we need a visual record of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think with this particular case, though, I believe that's what he's seeking. And I believe that a lot of this is what it's about, him with his sublimation in terms of doing his criminology degrees and criminal justice studies. And therefore, there's a part of me that doesn't want to give him that which he is seeking. But I do understand, because, yes, I do feel, you know, with the Menendez case in particular, there was no cameras in the second trial. And I feel that that was very problematic in terms of we didn't get to see or hear everything that was going on and understand the case. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens. Jim, do you have a view? We were just talking about the gag order And the Katie Gonzalez's family feel that they want the gag order removed. They, along with the Associated Press, have pushed for it being removed. And there's a hearing on June 9th. And that's also when they discuss the cameras being in court.
Right. Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not exactly certain why the judge issued the gag order, but I will say that, you know, many times when there is no gag order, then, you know, people are tried in the court of public opinion. And I don't think that helps the victims. I'm not sure why the victims' families want the gag order removed. Maybe they're impatient. Maybe they want to hear everything that's happening and they feel like they're being kind of kept in the dark. Well, that's probably true, but it's probably true for a reason. They probably need to be in order to preserve them as witnesses. And there's no question that if the family is kept up to speed on what's going on, many times there are leaks, and many times that can poison a jury pool, that can create a situation where the defense has more ammunition. And I'd rather preserve the process than the patience of the people on the outside. So I don't have a problem with the gag order. I do have a problem with people basically turning the defendant into some kind of icon.
And what do you think about cameras in the court, Jim?
Well, for prosecutors who have no experience with that, that could create a big difficulty for them. Also can create a circus. But I think it's a good thing to have. I think people who can't get there to see the trial, who have a real interest in it, should be able to see it. And I think just for the part in history this trial is going to play, I think it's important. But it is difficult to manage, and that's why it's up to the court who is trying the case.
Two other points then, just to wrap. The Kaylee Gonzalez family have put out a statement today, and I just want to read it because I think it might answer a couple of points and things we've discussed. The family would like to thank everyone for continuing to follow this case and keep the memories of Kaylee, Maddie, Zaina, and Ethan alive. They're what is important, not the defendant. We're thankful to the Latar County District Attorney's Office finally took the case to a grand jury and came back with an indictment. At the same time, we're disappointed that the judicial process has not been more efficient in addressing the gag order. This is just the beginning of a long journey for all the families, and we're thankful for your continued support and coverage.
So they throw a little elbow in there. They say something about that. It finally went to the grand jury. I mean, this is such a high-profile case, and nobody is not feeling empathy for these victims. Surely that prosecutor wants to go after this guy. Why do you think that they are sort of backhandedly
experienced in this? They don't understand how long it takes for the judicial system to work, and so they're frustrated. It's normal, but that they don't get what they want, because the justice system is meant to protect the defendant's rights so that justice can be found. If you don't protect the defendant's rights, then the defendant can drive a truck through that hole. And they'll have time and time and time again to retry the case. And they want to put as much muck into the system as they can. So they don't realize this because they haven't been exposed to the system. I totally understand how they feel. But I believe, just like some people complained about, why wasn't the investigation moving forward?
Right.
Well, we know for a fact that actually that entire time the investigation was moving forward. They just didn't make public statements, because they shouldn't make public statements while they're doing the investigation.
Yes, and that's exactly why in the UK it is sub judice. It is for good reason. We sympathize and understand how horrific it must feel to be silenced. And, you know, of course, we haven't been there ourselves, but when you're on the other side to it, they just want answers and they don't understand why the process is taking so long. But the judge did say no decisions would be made today about the gag order. It would be decisions would be taken on June the 9th for that and the cameras. So I have immense empathy, as we all do, for the families. We had a message from Abby on Twitter who had a question for us. And she wants to know whether, she says that she loves listening to RCP. She loves the podcast. And we talk with such compassion and intelligence about some of the most horrific cases. And she said she's a forensic science student, so we inspire her. Mm. But she wants to know whether we think that the evidence will be enough for the prosecution and jury to convict BK. And do we think that he's enjoying the publicity? Because she's read online, and she doesn't know whether it's true or false, that he apparently watches himself on TV in jail.
What the fuck? He can get a TV in jail?
That's, yeah, they do. Remember, he's innocent right now before proven guilty. So right. He's being held. It's not prison. He's being held as, right? So yes, he can see all of this. And if he is watching, that does tell us about the fact that he seems to be enjoying or wanting to keep up with what's being said about him. But I mean, our way in, do we think that there's enough evidence to convict him? Well, we don't really know all the evidence that exists as yet. We haven't been privy to the grand jury. There certainly seems to be a lot. We've talked about evidence in previous episodes, but of course, all evidence has to be tested. So if there is a history of stalking, if his cell phone did ping off towers multiple times around the home address, if his car was around their home address, because we know it was in quite an isolated area, i.e. it wasn't somewhere that you would just drive to on a thoroughfare. Mm. So if the evidence, and there's a long way to go, the DNA, all of this has to be tested in court. So a criminal defense lawyer would say there's plenty of opportunity to contest. I believe that there is a circumstantial mounting of evidence that will be put before the court. The grand jury decided it was enough to indict him. So I hope that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. As I always say in every case, it comes down to how well the investigation was done, dotting the I's, crossing the T's. Jim?
Yeah, and I agree. And yeah, of course, we don't know what all the evidence is, but we know that there's enough to prove probable cause. So it's more likely than not that he committed the crimes that he's been charged with. And we have to hope that the prosecution has enough to push that above the bar of beyond a reasonable doubt. And a lot of it's going to be based on his behavior. And some of it is the evidence that's there and also the evidence that doesn't exist. For example, him turning off his phone just for the hours that it would take for him to get from where he was to the crime scene and back. And then his phone comes back on. So that attempt to try to be forensically sophisticated actually screams out that he actually wasn't very forensically sophisticated and that he was trying to hide his behavior during that time period. Well, obviously, that looks like guilty behavior, and it's going to look like guilty behavior to the jury when it's presented to them.
Yeah, very good points. We said before, it's not always what you do, it's what you don't do. And that was the same in the Murdoch case with Alec Murdoch turning off his phone for the portion of time that the offences were committed. Levi Belfour turned off his phone for the portion of time. And when you've got someone who's a prolific phone user, it really stands out. So it's what they do and what they don't do. But I believe there's a mountain of evidence. Circumstantial, yes, there is some DNA. It all has to be challenged and contested, and hopefully it will stand up in court and we'll find out more, not from the probable cause hearing anymore, because that's not taking place on June the 26th, but we'll find out more at the, not even at the hearings, but at the trials, whether there'll be cameras or not. What do you think, Jim and Lisa? Do you think the judge will rule to have cameras, or do you think it will go the other way? Any thoughts?
I don't know. It's a small jurisdiction. I think that that's usually a huge burden for them to carry. But
yeah, they've already got a taste of it. They've already got a taste of all of this media being in everybody's business.
But hopefully they'll report or not they let it be aired at the time. That's another thing. As long as they record it visually, I think that's a good thing, you know, for historical purposes. And so that if there is any issue, that we can actually see what actually happened. Because, you know, Laura and Lisa, when you read somebody's testimony in a transcript, which is what a lot of the judges on an appeal panel will do, is read transcripts. That is not the subtotal of the evidence. I mean, being able to look at the person and assess them as they give the evidence. And it's unfortunate that we're not using this technology in every case, and every case isn't recorded that way, because I really believe that 70 to 90% of communication is nonverbal, and you can't see any of the nonverbals on a transcript.
Good point.
Exactly. And here's somebody who I believe loves the media. And if it is true, he's watching himself on TV, etc., the sublimation of his criminal justice studies, all of these things, then there's a part of me, Jim and Lisa, that doesn't want the cameras in court, because I don't want him to be given that which he is seeking. And, you know, I say that I don't want an innocent person sent to prison either. I want the evidence tested and thoroughly tested, and we want the right person to go to prison. But the point is, there is no other suspect within this investigation. All lines are pointing in one direction, and one direction only. But the eyes of the world will be on this case. And I just want us to end with thinking about Kaylee, Madison, Zaina, and Ethan, and thinking about their families and holding them uppermost in mind. And when you're posting, please post pictures of them. Please don't post pictures of BK. So we hope we've shed some light on some of these thorny legal matters that relate to this case, because I think it's really important people understand, from Jim, who's a former prosecutor, he understands the legalities of it rather than people making assumptions. And I think it's very important that we write the narrative and think about the victims. So thank you so much for listening to Real Crime Profile. For now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like listening to our show and appreciate the work that Jim and Laura do and their expertise, you can do us a big favor. Please head over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to our pod, and leave us a 5-star rating and write your thoughts about why you enjoy our show. It really, really is important and helps other people find us. Also, did you know that you can share our episode? It is so easy. On the Apple Podcast app, click the 3 dots drop down menu, and you'll see an option to share to your socials or to a particular person, and then they can hear for themselves why you love listening to Real Crime Profile. Thank you so much for your support.
Real Crime Profile was created by Jim Clementi, Laura Richards, and Lisa Zambetti. Produced by Laura Richards, Lisa Zambetti, Jim Clementi, and XG Productions, and distributed by Wondery. Editing by Nick Jaworski at Podcast Monster. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba.